Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. The 19th Amendment to the Constitution was approved in 1920. Have you ever wondered what that change has meant to our politics and our history? And our guest to talk about that is Heather Anderson. She is an assistant professor at Appalachian State University in the Department of Government and Justice Studies. She holds a PhD in political science and women's and gender studies. So we'll be talking with her about the effects of women voting and, of course, take your questions. Do you think voting is more important to women? What questions do you have about how women vote, perhaps? Join in. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Heather Anderson, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
How'd you get interested in this whole area of women in politics?
You know, I think it was just something that I kept on coming back to with different questions and ideas that I had that I found fascinating, that women make up 50% of the U.S. population, but have oftentimes been marginalized by politics, and trying to understand why and also how women have started to articulate their voice in politics.
So what are some of the misconceptions people have about how women vote?
Oh, geez. I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about how women vote, and I think it depends upon who you ask. One of the things that I would say is a big misconception out there is that women vote for women candidates because those candidates are women. But the reality is that partisanship is what is driving that much more than a shared gender affinity. Women do tend to be slightly more Democratic in terms of their partisanship, and we know more women candidates are Democrats, and so that's why you see more women vote, but it's really their partisanship driving that relationship there. Now, I should say the other big misconception is that women sort of are a cohesive block, and they're not. Race is a big sort of division within women in politics, where white women are more Democratic than white men, but they still tend to vote Republican on average, where non-white women are much more supportive of the Democratic Party than white women.
And do they vote more than black men vote, black women?
So that's hard to say, because oftentimes the data that we have is not the greatest in terms of that. But generally, it looks like, yes, black women are more supportive of the Democratic Party than black men, and they turn out to vote at a higher rate.
Let's look back in history a little bit. We just mentioned that women got the vote in 1920 nationally. What happened in the next election? Did many women exercise the right? That was, really so hardly fought for and won.
Yeah, and so it depends upon who you ask whether or not the 19th Amendment was successful and whether or not women, you know, used their right to vote or not. I think that the best way to look at it is that it was largely dependent upon local context. And so there were some places where, even though the 19th Amendment had been ratified, women were still not able to vote in the next presidential election because of registration laws. And so the registration date, the fact that we have to register before an election to be able to vote in it, had already passed. And the states just sort of said, oops, too bad. Come out next time. Other states, though, adopted different registration laws for that particular legislation, or made provisions for women to be able to register and get out to vote in that presidential election. We know that women turned out less than men. They continued to turn out less than men until about 1980. But really the same factors, those local political contexts in terms of how hard it was to vote, and then also how strong the political parties were really critical in shaping whether or not women turned out to vote. So in addition to the difficulty concerning registration, you also had in locations where there were two competitive political parties, the parties had this incentive to mobilize women and get women out to vote because they could make a difference in the election. And so you had women voting at much higher rates where there were two competitive parties. Compared to where there was one party that was dominant, you had fewer women turn out to vote in those contexts, but you also had fewer men turn out to vote also in those contexts.
Interesting. Were women of color more affected by barriers that were put up?
Well, we should keep in mind that when the 19th Amendment was passed, while people of color had the right to vote according to the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, most southern states had disenfranchised people of color through a variety of different Jim Crow pieces of legislation. And African-American women and black women were sort of disenfranchised in the same sort of manner as black men in those locations. And so there is sort of that other element there that especially in until 1965, you have black women largely disenfranchised through various different restrictions passed in those southern states.
And that's not that long back.
No, it's not that long ago in terms of participation in politics.
Oh, boy. We're talking with Heather Anderson. She is an assistant professor at Appalachian State University in the Department of Government and Justice Studies, taking a look at the lasting effects of women getting the vote, the effects on our society. In general, and I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@WPR.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with Professor Heather Anderson. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the changes in politics and history since women got the right to vote in 1920 with our guest, Heather Anderson. She is an assistant professor at Appalachian State University in the Department of Government and Justice Studies. So what would you like to know about the effect of women getting the vote? Maybe something about the history of it. Join in the conversation. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. How long did it take for women's votes to make a difference in elections, Heather, really?
So that's a difficult question to answer because one of the reasons why is we didn't keep men's and women's ballots separate. And so while we, you know, could get a feel sort of how things were changing or shifting, we didn't have from about 1920 to the 1950s the survey data that we oftentimes rely on today to estimate how different demographic groups voted. Now, with that said, women and men tended to vote fairly similar for quite a few election cycles, or at least it's estimated that they have done that. However, when we start to experience the New Deal realignment in the 1940s, you start to see some changes going on there. Not drastic changes, but probably sort of the start to some movement in terms of that. It's not, though, until the 1980s that what is referred to as the gender gap, or a significant difference between how men and women cast their ballots, really sort of solidified. And so some people would say it's not until 1980. Other people would say that women had a more influential influence earlier on.
Well, it may have had something to do with the platforms of the political parties, or maybe changes or defining them more clearly for women.
A lot of people point to 1980 as a critical election because it's the first election where you see the parties differentiate on issues dealing with both abortion and the Equal Rights Amendment. The Equal Rights Amendment up until that time had sort of a varied history in terms of partisan support. So it was an amendment proposed actually by Alice Paul, who started actively pushing for the Equal Rights Amendment almost immediately after the 19th Amendment was passed. And it was first sort of considered by the Republican Party. The Democrats weren't very supportive of it because of the union presence within the Democratic Party, but then the unions got on board. And for several decades before 1980, both parties were really supportive of the Equal Rights Amendment. But in 1980, you see the parties change. And in particular, the Republican Party takes an anti-ERA stance in their party platform, and the Democratic Party continues to support the Equal Rights Amendment. Additionally, you see differences between the party in 1980 emerge over the issue of abortion, where the Republican Party takes a anti-abortion stance in their party platform, and the Democrats take a more pro-choice stance in their party platform. What's really interesting, though, is that men and women don't differ really in their support for issues of abortion and for issues of the Equal Rights Amendment. What I think is probably going on more are some things that are happening in the 1970s that lead to these changes in the parties, but really lead to a sort of realignment going on between the different groups that compose the political parties. And in particular, in the 1970s, you have an anti-feminist counter-movement to the feminist movement emerge. Phyllis Schlafly's oftentimes listed as the leader of that movement, but there were a variety of different women active in that movement. And you had not only anti-feminist, but pro-family, sort of all converging. And it was really the initial momentum was anti-Equal Rights Amendment, and that group is able to gain footing and power within the Republican Party based upon people that they know and are then influential in helping select more socially conservative candidates, and then also the changes that we see occur in the platforms, where with the Democratic Party, feminists were able to exert more influence within that party throughout the 1970s, preserving sort of the stances of the party come 1980 and not really changing things.
Yeah. Where are we with the Equal Rights? What's the latest on the Equal Rights Amendment?
So I am not a constitutional law scholar, but the Equal Rights Amendment had a deadline for ratification, which is actually odd. Most amendments, when sent to the states for ratification, don't have that sort of deadline on them. At the time of the deadline, three states had still not, or three, it was necessary for three states to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Since then, the three states have ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, although the deadline has passed, and so people aren't quite sure how to take that. Additionally, several states had voted to rescind their support for the Equal Rights Amendment. And it's unclear if they can do that legally. So we're sort of in this debate. The simple answer is the Equal Rights Amendment is not part of the Constitution. There is not any explicit guarantee of equal protection under the law on the basis of sex or gender in the Constitution. The more complicated answer is it's sort of in this legal limbo of not really sure where it stands.
Yeah, and I guess some of the folks who are against it, if it passed, it could be perceived as giving women then the right to use their body how they please.
So,
in terms of perhaps abortion.
Perhaps, but a lot of the legal scholars don't actually feel that that would be an implication of it, that it would have very little standing on issues dealing with abortion and reproductive rights, at least the way that the law has currently constructed those issues. And so while it is something that we hear a lot about in terms of an implication of the Equal Rights Amendment, from my understanding, most legal scholars would say that it would not be used in that manner.
Let's take some calls. If you'd like to join in, have a question or comment, I hope you will. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Martha in Menominee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm really interested in the discussion about women voting, and particularly in light of the most current elections. Sort of two ends of this spectrum. I wonder if your guest could address this. The importance of Trump courting suburban women, you know, the famous quote, suburban women, will you please love me? And then the importance of the black mothers and grandmothers and women that came out and put Wisconsin blue through Madison, Milwaukee, Kenosha, Green Bay, that black women's vote versus white suburban women. Can your guest, and hello from Boone, North Carolina, of course, but can your guest address that? Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, those are great questions. So to take the second one first in terms of addressing black women's vote, black women's vote is critical to a lot of the Democratic Party's success, not only in terms of Wisconsin, but in terms of the special election in Alabama, where Dan Jones, a white Democrat, was able to be elected to the Senate for a short term. He has since been defeated. His win was really a product of black women mobilizing, getting out there and contacting and other black women and building these social networks to bring voters to the polls. Additionally, the Democratic or Georgia turning blue in the presidential election, plus in the special election or the runoff election that also went for the Democratic Party. Once again, black women were extremely critical to that win. And not only in just Stacey Abrams organizing, but the Black mothers, grandmothers, non-mothers getting out and mobilizing and building strong social networks in terms of getting people to the polls. And I really think that when you look at where the Democratic Party is some of the strongest, it's where you have those networks of non-white women, especially working to mobilize voters and get them to the polls. And so the Democratic Party should be really cognizant of that going forward. As for the suburban voters, it's actually weird when we start to study things in politics that we really don't have a good definition of what's a suburb. We know what an urban area is and we know what a rural area is, but how do we classify a suburb? And what we generally know, or what we can generally say, is that once again, it was about race and somewhat about education playing a role in terms of shaping white women's votes in those suburbs, or women's votes in those suburbs. White women with a college education did not love Trump like he pleaded them to. And so you had them voting more towards Biden along with Black women. White women without a college education were more supportive of Trump. And so it just varied in terms of those lines. But that was the same whether or not the woman was living in the suburbs, in a rural area, or in an urban area.
Interesting. Thanks very much for that question. And again, you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Scotty in Manitowoc, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, one thing that's interesting about women's right to vote was that Native American women were not allowed, or men, until 1924, when the Snyder Act was passed, recognizing Native Americans as American citizens and therefore qualified to vote. So actually, Native American women were the last women to be allowed to vote.
Come on, Heather.
So, yeah, that's a really great point in terms of, one, the varied impact of the 19th Amendment. It did not just mean all women could vote. Rather, there were still quite a few restrictions on voting in the United States. And I actually love that you bring up Native American women, because we think of so often the trajectory of voting rights in the U.S. as very linear. Groups go from not having voting rights to having voting rights, and then it's sort of preserved. But in fact, what we see is that there's oftentimes waves and movement forward and movement back and that. And what's really interesting is actually before there was a United States, women in many Native American tribes had voting rights within their own tribes and on councils and served as leaders. And it was when then the United States became the United States and became established as a country, and all Native Americans really lost their right to vote until it was reestablished, you have sort of this movement backwards for some time and that. And we should keep in mind that Native American voting rights are something that, once again, even today is sort of in a precarious situation with some of the laws that have been passed around the country in terms of voter IDs requiring a street address, because many reservations might not have that street address. And different factors that could still limit the rights of Native Americans to vote today.
Scotty, thank you so much for that question and comment. How has the the view of women candidates changed over the years, you think?
So I think one of the things is that women candidates are becoming much more common, and it's we can see that progression not only at the sort of national level, right? We go from rarely having a woman throw their hat into the ring for one of the major political party tickets to, in the last two cycles, multiple women emerging as candidates. And we see this happening at lower levels of elected office, too. So I think we're becoming more familiar with women candidates, and they're becoming less of a novelty. However, that does not necessarily mean that voters still might not bring some stereotypes about issue competencies or concerns about electability to make their decisions when thinking about different candidates.
Let's talk about Kamala Harris. What does her election mean to maybe society and politics, do you think?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think it means is the long-term effects. We talk about sometimes sort of a role model effect, where when individuals see themselves reflected by the people who are in elected office, it has some very important and long-term effects on a variety of different orientations to politics. And so, for instance, when women are in elected office, younger girls express more interest in politics than when they don't have those role models. And so having a non-white woman is going to be really critical to sort of the long-term engagement of women in politics and really changing that. And then I think also it provides a great example of, and this is, we oftentimes are a little leery of new things when we encounter them in the world, and the same goes with politics and our elected officials, that for some people it will act as a reassuring effect that, there was this woman in power and in a position of power, and, things went fine, and they'll be able to take that and update some of their attitudes and opinions. And so it should have, both long-term and maybe more immediate effects on the electability of women candidates.
And so as we think back now and look at the 1920 to the present, what are the... Started to wind this up in the last couple of minutes. What do you think are the major social changes and effects of women having the vote on our society?
Oh, geez. So one, I think it just gives our government greater legitimacy. When you have more people electing government officials and creating the rules of law, the laws become more legitimate in terms of things. And so I think there's just a bigger aspect of American democracy that's important to consider. Additionally, I think that there are so many different pieces of legislation and different policies, from student loans to fair credit to just so many different things that have been fundamentally shaped by women voting for candidates that support these policies, but then also by women being elected and taking their experiences and having them help shape the policy outputs of government.
So are we going to have a woman as president at some point in our history?
Well, at some point we will. How soon, I will say I'm not fully sure. We are, though, one of the things that's, you know, important to keep in mind is that there becomes more and more sort of women in the pipeline. As more women get elected to gubernatorial elections and in Senate elections and other places, there become more women that resemble sort of some of the traditional candidates that we see running for president. And so I think that, you know, that will be a factor. Although I will say I hold my breath that it's going to happen in the next election, or that just because we do know that there are still a lot of people will say that they'll vote for a woman candidate. But if you ask them if their neighbor will vote for a woman candidate, they'll say no.
Oh, and that this is an interesting conversation. Heather, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Heather Anderson is an assistant professor at Appalachian State University in the Department of Government and Social Studies. Great to have her along today. Let's look ahead. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Aaron Presley's back to talk about summer gardening and some ideas for native plants you can plant that add a lot of color at this time of the year. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mehler.